good to see everyone this evening, and starting to continue to feel like we're getting more and more in the groove of services. Does anyone need a copy of the questions? Raise your hand, please. Well, misled.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Yeah?
Next week.
We're still getting back into normal. We're still trying to find normal. Thanks, Logan, for reading. And I think it's important for us as we think about chapter 13 to first of all remember where we left in chapter 12. Remember how it ended with Jesus in verse 48 asking a question of the one bringing in this urgent message. He then turned to the multitude, the message of his family is wanting to see him, and how Jesus then, he turned to the multitude with outreached arms and said, "Behold my," or something like, "Behold my mother, my brothers." I think that's pretty powerful. Let's look at verse 20, 49 and 50. And he stretched out his hand toward his disciples and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." Whoever does the will of the Father in heaven. Now we get to move on then to the parable of the soils. Look at verse 1. Look at verse 1 and try to imagine Jesus. Now, Matt and I, we've been on the water together. And when you get on the water early morning, late evening, and you know, the water carries a sound. It's amazing. It's amazing how sound can carry on water. You know, Lance and I have sat on a boat out in the water at night, and you can hear everything. It's phenomenal. And so here's Jesus now. And I see this of an evening. Maybe the temperature's cooled down a little bit. And Jesus is walking down now from a house that some believe might be Peter or Andrew's house. And Jesus is walking down now to the water's edge, maybe thinking he's going to relax, but knowing as soon as he's out, people are going to start flooding. And that's what happened. People started moving in on him, trying to listen and get closer to him. I'm speculating a little bit, but for me, it seems like maybe they were looking for a miracle. They were looking to be fed, because this is the same people that were described as dull of hearing and unable to see. So for whatever reason, the people are pressing on Jesus, and then Jesus then gets in the boat, and he's able to preach from the boat. I think that's pretty impressive. I like that scene and trying to understand how it all unfolded, and now we get into the clicker. There's question number one. Covers quite a few verses, and they're packed in there pretty tight. But question number one, and Lauren, I think maybe Grant might have, yeah. Trace, if you will, question number one, why did Jesus start teaching in parables, and at what point in his ministry? Why not before?
Okay. I like this part of Matthew. I think that Jesus starts his parables from what I read and commentators all through. I think he starts it simply to make it more practical and easy for his listeners to understand. It's a pretty simple answer, but I just think at this point, what he was trying to explain was easier to explain with parables, because it was more practical for the Jewish people.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, anyone else have anything to add? Warren?
Well, I'll take the opposite trace. In 12:14, it says, "Then the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might destroy him." So at this point, Jesus, he changes his delivery method so it would only be understood by people who truly were seeking to understand, rather than people who were just there to either accuse him are just there for the free fish and bread and so forth.
Uh-huh. Right. Anyone else? So verse 10 of this chapter, his disciples are asking him, why are you teaching in parables? And kind of like what, you know, Trace and Lauren were alluding to as well, I think, is that Jesus knew the people were dull of hearing. They weren't seeing what was in front of them. And there were those that were there to entrap him as well. Austin?
Something kind of struck me, too. Jesus, up till this point in time, had been preaching about the kingdom. The kingdom is near. The kingdom is at hand. And doing all kinds of miracles to prove this. And given the events of chapter 12, specifically what we studied last week, as far as the Pharisees come out seeking a sign, right? And he basically tells them, you're hard-hearted, you're seeking after a sign, you're not right with God. To me, that seems to be just the last point. That's the final straw for Jesus. And then he, to me, it shows more of Jesus' compassion that he starts teaching parables at this point, because he's, similar to what Lauren said, trying to hide the things of the kingdom from those that won't understand or don't want to understand, while revealing them, as he will talk about later, to those who are truly seeking after the kingdom. Up till this point in time, it's open for everyone, and he's teaching it to whosoever will, but there's some lessons that he now understands these people are not willing to understand. They're not willing to hear. So to me, this is a prime example of Jesus' love and his compassion, because he continues to extend it till he gets to this point, and he finally gets to a point where it's not open for everybody to hear these lessons in just blunt talk.
Yeah, right. Protecting the mysteries, still trying to build up, to teach the common people that were willing to listen, not just common people. We know some of the Pharisees believed as well. Anyone else? Matt?
Real quick. Luke places this event in chapter 8, which would happen before it happens in Matthew's gospel. But Matthew, the words that Matthew uses in when he talks about when they come to him about his mother, his brothers, it says while he was speaking to the crowds.
Right.
And here it says that day. So very specific sequence of events that Matthew reports here, whereas Luke does not use that sort of sequence of events. He's arranging some of these things a little differently than Matthew is. So we don't need to think that Luke and Matthew are disagreeing here.
Yeah.
Matthew would have been privy to these events. He would have been there and could have reported the sequence more succinctly than Luke could have. Luke was just putting the events in there.
Yeah, I appreciate you pointing out Luke. Because Mike Criswell, he pointed out, this. I had it in question number 4, but Mike Criswell pointed out that Matthew's focus was on the hearer, chapter 13, verse 19. Mark's focus was on the sower, and Luke's focus was on the seed. So they took different approaches to this same situation, which I think is obviously helpful. We get more information that way, and we're able to put a better picture together of what was taking place. And then the second question, why not before? I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know why. Parables were used, the Sermon on the Mount. There were some parables sprinkled in the Sermon on the Mount, but not set up like this, where Jesus is acknowledging them as parables. All I could really say was the time wasn't right. Matthew chapter 13, verse 34. Matthew 13, verse 34 reads, all these things Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables, and without a parable he did not speak. So his teaching now is really coming into the parables at this time. Anyone else on question number 1? We probably ought to keep moving. All right, question number 2, and I can't believe I remembered to flip the screen. Question number 2, what are the mysteries of the kingdom? Why were they given to the disciples but not to the crowds that listened? Lauren?
Greg Coffin's commentary, he had a whole list of mysteries. But here, I think the mystery seems to relate to the nature of the kingdom, that it will be open to those who seek it and work for it rather than people who are born into it. If we reference Ephesians 3:3-6, says, "How that by revelation made known to me the mystery, as I have briefly written already, by which then you read, you may understand my knowledge and the mystery of Christ, which in other ages was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets, that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs of the same body and partakers of his promise in Christ through the gospel." So in this, you know, it's stating that the apostles would be those who delivered this, and that the Gentiles would be fellow heirs. So for the last part, why were they given to the disciples but not to the crowds that listen? I think there's two reasons here. As we have previously discussed, the mystery was revealed to them because in verse 16, they had eyes that see and ears that hear. They followed Jesus because they truly wanted to know. And the second reason was, as we just saw there in Ephesians, it would soon be their responsibility to spread the message of Jesus around the globe. They had to understand it because they would have to teach these truths to others.
Yeah. And even with the disciples having eyes that saw and ears that heard, I found myself thinking about the disciples so many times, they still struggled themselves. You know, they struggled themselves with their own, with prejudiceness, the ability to see clearly. But Jesus was willing to work with them, as you pointed out, because they had a heart. They desired the truth. Anyone else here on question number two? All right, let's look at question number three. In what ways are we the most blessed people in history? Malin, would you like that?
I feel that we're the most blessed people in history because we have the revealed word of God in the Bible in its entirety. And we have the big picture in front of us, and that helps us to better understand what we need to do to be saved. And along with that, we also have access to so many different resources that they didn't have back then and throughout time. Things have been getting better. It's easier to read the Bible. You can find all kinds of words in milliseconds, you know. And these things can help us to know what we need to do. And then also, you know, just a side point, you know, we're not really persecuted for our beliefs, and we have freedoms to worship how we want. And so mainly, I believe, it's the revealed word of God.
Yeah, very good. I think all those things are right. Anyone else have anything to add to question number three? Pretty well touched on. You know, I went back to verse 17. Interesting, and we've seen this in other places and during other studies, how the people of old, the prophets, the righteous men of old, you know, how they desired to know the things that are now right here in front of these people, the disciples. To me, that's pretty powerful. I like that thought. Anyone else on question number? Yeah, Austin.
When I read verses 16 and 17, I can't help but think about Hebrews 11. Really, the whole chapter, won't read the whole chapter, but verse 39 and 40 there, "All these, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect." And that, to me, just kind of hits you square in between the eyes, because you look at all of those great people of faith, people that literally talked with God, that saw his miracles, that had miracles performed through them, and yet they didn't get to see and taste and be a part of the things that we are. And like Jesus was talking in Matthew 11 about John the Baptist, that there's not been a prophet born of women greater than John the Baptist, and yet the least in the kingdom is greater than he.
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of awe to me, realizing where we're at now is so far and away better than what they had ever experienced, even though they had done so many things and were faithful to God. He provided some better thing for us.
Nah, very well put. Appreciate that very much. Anything else? Question number three. All right, let's look at number four. Describe the task of the sower. Why does he sow seeds in places that are not considered good ground? Landon?
So the sower is tasked with spreading the gospel throughout the world. Obviously, the soil is representing people and their hearts and how they accept the seed. And so why does he sow in places that are not considered good ground? I have 2 points here. God is a generous God, and he gives to everyone equally. In Matthew 5, verse 45, I believe it is, he says, "That you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust." And so we can see he's a fair and just God. And the second point is about free will. One could argue that if God were to take back the seeds that had fallen on not good ground, he revokes their free will and condemns them to die.
Very good point. Very good. Very good. Anyone else on question number four? Awesome.
I think you appropriately put in your slide that this is the parable of the soils and not the parable of the sower.
Right.
Because if you start looking at, you know, why didn't the sower just target the good ground? Love what Landon said. Excellent point. But that should tell us something about preaching the gospel. When you preach the gospel, it's not just to certain people. And you can't pick and choose who you're going to save. The gospel's open to whosoever will. And when the sower sows, when you preach the gospel, and I think it's illustrated in the sower in this passage, right. When you preach the gospel, you don't know which one is the good ground, which one's the stony, the thorny, or even the wayside. That's not for us to know.
Right.
You might have a guess, but oftentimes those guesses aren't even correct. So our job is not to decide what the best soil is. Our job is to spread the seed. And as long as we're spreading the seed, there's always a chance that could become fruitful wherever it might land.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Anyone else? Dennis?
Yeah, I just thought about the story of Jonah. You know how?
Yeah.
Why, God? I want to know the priests of these people. They're not even our people.
Yeah.
Never know when there's going to be a little bit of good soil in with the bad soil.
Right.
So that's not our job.
That's a good point. Good point with none. Lance, did you have your hand? Okay. I thought I saw another hand over there. Lord.
Well, I kind of agree with Landon's point. 2 Peter 3:9, the Lord's not slack. He wants all to be saved. So he's looking for all to be saved, so he gives everyone a chance. This is maybe kind of a strange thought, but we think about, you know, you draw who the sower is, and you know, maybe the sowers are Christians, but a lot of people put it as being God. If you think about how seeds go about in the natural world, you might see a cedar tree growing out the side of a mountain or whatever. Those seeds in the natural world, seeds just kind of go everywhere, and they have the chance to go down wherever they, you know, if there's fertile ground there, they'll grow. So it made me kind of think about, maybe you see that God puts things where humans wouldn't necessarily do it.
Yes, another good point. Anyone else? I've got a little bit stranger point than that, maybe, at least it was to me. Again, reading from Mike Criswell, he quoted a writer named Bross, quote, "In other things, a man must know in order to love. In religion, he must love in order to know. I read that about three times. You meet someone and you get to know them before you start to love, truly love them. Makes sense. That's kind of how we work. But with religion, you have a love for the truth. You have a love for God, a love for Christ. And that's how you grow religiously. Okay. Any other point? That's what you did, Lance. You did one of these things, and I thought you raised your hand. Okay. Okay, question number five. Question number five. What are two common ways that Christians can become unfruitful? What can we do to help Christians such as these? Logan?
Mm-hmm. I've got one way, and I think it's basically going to be the main way. Everyone probably came up with this, but it's the idea of becoming stagnant, becoming lukewarm, in other words. And there are many ways you can go about this, but let's say you're a Christian. You've been baptized, maybe you've been a member for some odd years, but you don't have, as you said, you don't have this love for the Lord. You don't have a love for the gospel. So you're not looking to make yourself better. You're not looking to spread the word. And in this way, you become unfruitful. I mean, you may, it might be your routine not to commit these sins. Maybe you've put these sins away and you're not committing what you used to. But if you're not striving to share the word and become a better Christian, you're still being unfruitful to some degree.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I'm thinking about athletics. If you're not continuing to try to strength train or whatever you're doing, you're not keeping up. So it's the idea of growing, continuing to try to grow. I think that was one of the main points. Anything else? Anyone else? Lauren?
On the verse, there are two things: cares of the world and deceitfulness of the riches. So, cares of the world, not necessarily evil things, it's just busyness. So, examples of that from Scripture are Matthew 6:25, where Jesus tells us, don't worry. Also, 1 Corinthians 7:33 talks about being married and you have to care for your wife. So, there's cares of the world that would sometimes get in the way. And then we have deceitfulness of riches, seeking unneeded wealth. Matthew 6:24, cannot serve God and mammon. 1 Timothy 6:10, love of money and the root is all kinds of evil. And that really connects in with this verse.
Yeah.
It's all over with all sorts of sorrows. In Luke 8:14, there's a third reason added, and that's pleasures. 1 Timothy 5:6, it's talking about the widow indeed, and widow indeed can't be a woman who seeks pleasure. And Luke 16:19-31, we see that the rich man, in the parable of the rich man on Lazarus, the rich man lived in pleasure.
Yeah. Anyone else? Or question number five. Austin?
This is kind of for the second part of that question. As far as helping Christians, and I do believe that he's describing Christians here that receive the word, but then they have something within themselves that causes them to die out. Again, proving that that one can fall from grace, that you're not, there's no such thing as what the Calvinists believe, that once you're saved, you're always saved. But also, I don't think that you just fit into that mold either, that everyone is either a good ground or a thorny, they themselves. Similar to what you were talking about with athletics, good ground, I mean, almost every field that you look at here in America once started out as a forest, right? Before that time, you have to cultivate that good ground in order to make it become good ground. So inevitably, if we're not cultivating the good ground, if we're not rooting out the things that aren't supposed to be there, getting the stones out of the way, then ultimately we're going to fall to these same
the temptations, the deceitfulness of riches, or the tribulation of persecution, if we aren't continually trying to improve ourselves, yeah. Continually trying to get those things out of our lives. I think these could be anybody, but it's specifically those that aren't continually trying to improve themselves are the ones that have stony ground, that have no depth within themselves. They're not growing in faith. They're not trying to be better in that sense. Or, you know, thorns, it talks about there. Those are things that just pop up. And you look at gardens and things like that, and anyone who's had a garden knows that you get weeds in there all the time. And if you aren't killing those weeds off or hoeing them out or whatever the case might be, they're going to grow up and they're going to ruin whatever plant you're trying to grow. Unless you're on top of that, your fruitfulness is going to be impacted, yeah. And ultimately it could die. So to me, and that kind of spills into question number 6, but what can you do to help those people is encouraging them whenever you might see that they have a stone in their life that's, not trying to cross analogies here, but a stumbling block. You have a stone that's causing them, whatever the persecution or tribulation is, to not be strong, or you see that they have thorns in their life that's choking them out, is helping them cultivate that, helping them get that out of their lives, working it. You have to work in your life, you have to work the ground in order to make it good ground. That's just my 2 cents.
Yeah, I took this second question kind of personal, like, what can we do to help? You know, what can I do? What can Lauren do? What can, you know, the deacons, what can a brethren do to help? And I went through about 4 different ways that Christians can become unfruitful. And as I was trying to look at each one of those, I kept coming back to stay in touch, stay in touch, stay in touch. You know, offer direction, try to help provide some guidance, and offer some study opportunities and some opportunities to meet and discuss things together. So they're saying, and things that I need to be better at, and I hope to be better at in the future. But I think all of us can look at ourselves and say, I can do better. I need to be more engaged. I need to be more encouraging. I need to offer opportunities to hang out and try to work with a brother a little bit. Anyone else? Matt.
So as Austin brought up, someone that believes in the once saved, always saved doctrine actually will agree with us in one thing. That's that the person at the very end is the only saved person. What they'll say, though, is that he was the only saved person at any point. Yeah. Because he heard with a good and honest heart, right. Or he heard and received the word well. But Luke's account in chapter 8, verse 13 says about the rocky soil, those who are the rocky soil who believe for a time, and that's actually what Luke says. He says they believe for a while. They believe for
right.
a while.
Right.
Matthew doesn't say that, but Luke says that. And I don't know how you can say that someone like, especially if you believe, if you profess to say that belief is the only thing that saves you, if that person believes for a while, why are they ultimately not saved?
Yeah, very good point. Very good point. Anyone else? All right, let's look at question number 6. When does ground become good? Another interesting question. At what point do people have to be to receive the word and bear fruit? Levi?
So I had a hard time answering this question. So
I did too.
Yeah, hopefully I don't mess up the timeline here. The ground is good when the hearer has an honest and open heart, wanting to do whatever they can to reach salvation. And then, once they understand and follow through, they bear fruit. So that's what I have.
Yeah, well, I think that you're right on it. You know, a whole lot fewer words than I'll stumble around with. Anyone else have anything to add to question number 6? Austin?
Don't mean to just take up a bunch of time, but Levi's absolutely right. Honesty is the best policy. We know that saying, but it's a lot harder to live by. And for me personally, I think honesty is one of the rarest things to come by in this world, because a lot of times when we're approached with something, and especially people out in the world, when they are approached with the truth, and it make them make a decision, whether they're going to change their lives, deny themselves, or whatever the case might be, a lot of people don't have the honesty in their hearts to say that this is something that I have to do, or that I'm wrong and that this is right. Instead, they would rather live a lie that makes them feel good instead of having an honest heart that's grounded, that's cultivated, that's deep, that can allow the truth to take root. Honesty is a very rare thing. It's the best policy. I think it's hard to come by.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Anyone else? Question number six. Matt?
Maybe that there are gradients of production in the faith. Not the most productive tree is not the only tree that is seen as fruitful and worthy of staying in the orchard.
Right.
Now, some Christians will produce less, inevitably, and some will produce more. That isn't a showing of God's favor toward them, and their salvation is not affected by their production so long as they are producing.
Right. It kind of reminds me of a fruit tree that Dennis had for years. I can't remember if you cut it down or not, but it wasn't producing fruit. Anyone else on question number six? I found that to be an interesting question. And I don't remember who I was reading from, but thinking about the thorny soil, there was a lot of things going on in this thorny soil. The seeds were planted, they germinated, they grew, and then they were choked out. There was a lot of activity, the distractions of the world. I thought that was kind of a heart that is distracted by the cares of the world, can't focus. And honesty, similar to that first question, honesty, I had when the heart is good, when the heart's honest, that's when you have good ground to work with. And then that second part, I thought that was a tough question. And I got two answers. At what point do people have to be to receive the word and bear fruit? They have to be at a point where they're willing to receive the word. They have to have an open heart, be willing to receive the word, to receive that planted seed. And then secondly, to bear fruit, the heart must have a love for God, Christ, and the word, the seed. Anyone else got anything to add here? All right. Appreciate very much everyone's participation.